International Relations Department lectures on the transatlantic relationship after September the 11th. Before I introduce tonight's speaker, let me remind you about the third of the lectures, which takes place on Thursday the 4th of December in the Old Theatre, when Professor Joe Grieco will be talking about America Adrift, Myths and Realities about the United States and the New World Order. This evening, the topic of the lecture is After the Death of NATO, From Lapsed Alliance to New Partnership, and I'm very happy to welcome Professor Francois Heisberg here to give this lecture. He's the chairman of the Foundation Council of the Geneva Center for Security Policy, the director of the Foundation for Strategic Studies in Paris, the chairman of the Council of the International Institute for Strategic Studies. He began his career in the French diplomatic service. In 1981, he was international security advisor to the Minister of Defense. In 1988, he became director of the IISS, and he was there until 1992. He's written extensively in French and English on international security issues, for example, a book on the future of warfare, European defense, the implementation, and a book which sadly hasn't been translated into English, on hyper-terrorism, the new war. Francois, welcome.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you very much indeed, Margot, for these very kind words. And it's a real pleasure to be here with you this evening, and I thank you for receiving me in this great institution. Now, the proposition that I will put forward to you is that indeed, in many ways, NATO is dead. That, of course, is a provocation, and it will be that part of the proposition will be heavily qualified as I go on. But that precisely because in many ways that alliance is a lapsed alliance, it is possible, and indeed I would argue necessary, to seek the terms of a new partnership. But as we shall also see, getting from here to there is not going to be easy. Now, what underpins this proposition is not a reaction to the rather atrocious state of affairs which exists between the American administration, the Bush administration, and its counterparts in Europe, these counterparts be they of a friendly disposition, as is the case of your government, or be they of a less friendly disposition, as in France or Germany. What I would argue is that what underpins this death of the alliance and the possibility of moving towards a new partnership are changes which are, to a very large extent, if not essentially, distinct from what has been going on between Washington and its European partners, such as they are, since the election of George W. Bush, but are the effect of the fundamental changes. Now, what are these fundamental changes in the international system? Now, the first point that I would put here is that these changes are actually quite a direct consequence of the end of the Cold War. Now, that may sound rather worse than banal, since, after all, the Cold War did cease to be an operative factor since something like 13 years or 14 years ago, depending on where you count from. Yet, the consequences of the end of the Cold War in terms of the functioning of the international system have filtered into the international system only in a gradual manner, and particularly so in Europe and into the European-American relationship. Now, I'll enumerate these changes, then I'll draw some corollaries from them, look at the state of NATO, and then examine what the new partnership could look like. The changes. First of all, the United States is the sole superpower. Now, that we have known since the demise of the former Soviet Union. But there are two aspects which I'd like to highlight. The first is that the fact that the United States is the world's only superpower has been translated only rather recently into strategic language on the American side. That is, it has now become a facet of America's strategic posture to actively resist the emergence of any peer competitor, whether this peer competitor is a rising China, an ascendant China, or whether it is a gradually coalescing European Union, which would somehow position itself as a rival to the United States of America. This is the objective, one of the objectives which has been formalized in the National Security Strategy for the U.S. document, for the U.S., the document which came out in September of last year. The second aspect, which I will only mention en passant, and we may want to come back to that in the discussion later on, because it's not the primary focus of this lecture, is that although the United States is the sole superpower, it is actually a comparatively weak superpower. This is not an empire in the traditional meaning of that word. This is a country which, for various reasons, could not dictate even to Ottawa and Mexico the course to be taken during the Iraq crisis. And this is a country which is also encountering the most extreme difficulties in sustaining in the field a force as small as 120,000 soldiers for a period going beyond 9 or 10 months of deployment. By any standard, these two examples, and there are many others one could cite, do tend to show that the United States is not what one would call a hegemonic or an imperial superpower. It is the only one we have, but it's a comparatively weak one. Second big change, one which Don Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz cited very quickly after the attacks of September 11th. The second change is contained in their formula, which is the mission determines the coalition. Now, this in many ways could be construed at the time either as an expression of ideological preference and or as a statement of immediate operational fact, that is, the Americans, for very good reasons, wanted to go to Afghanistan straight away and were not going to allow themselves to be slowed down by the use of NATO machinery and limited NATO capabilities. No, it is much more than that. It is actually quite a good description of what the post-Cold War world looks like. During the Cold War, we had a permanent long-standing mission, and therefore we had a permanent long-standing coalition or sets of coalitions, NATO and Europe, the hubs and spokes set of defense alliances between the United States and its Asian partners in Asia Pacific. Nowadays, we have a succession of crises involving changing casts of actors and indeed, as we all know, a high degree of fluidity of the contingencies which have to be faced, and each contingency will indeed call for a different type of coalition. Third change, and that is one which does not come from the United States, and that is the change which has to do with the strategic situation itself. That is, we are indeed facing the combination of the threat of proliferation, traditional proliferation of weapons of mass destruction to a larger number of states, and indeed with the a real risk of a breakdown of the actually quite efficient multilateral constraints, primarily the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which helped contain the number of nuclear states between 1968 and the end of the 90s, the breakdown of the international non-proliferation regime on the one hand, and the prospect of non-state actors acquiring the means of mass destruction. This has this very real, very important threat, and we may want to discuss that further also in the discussion, carries with it a corollary, and that is the Atlantic Alliance, vis-à-vis this type of threat, is not an adequate locus. The threat of terrorism with a global reach and the threat of the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, these things are not going to be readily countered by an organization with the culture of NATO and with the geographical ambit in terms of its membership of NATO. These are things which can involve, to no lesser a degree, countries such as Russia or China or India or Japan. Last major change which I'd like to emphasize here, and that is that Europe has ceased to be an area of major strategic concern for the United States of America. And this, of course, is a marvelous development. The removal of the Soviet threat first, the end of the, and I touch wood here, the end of the wars of Yugoslav succession at the turning point between the 20th and the 21st century, have led to a situation in which, although there are still risks, there are still tensions in Europe, from the standpoint of the United States, we are clearly no longer this area calling for an enormous amount of American defense investment. We are no longer in Europe importers of security. This is, once again, a marvelous development. But this development does reinforce the US tendency not to place strategic value on unity for unity's sake of either the European Union, the European integration process, or of NATO. Furthermore, this trend is occurring as the European Union is expanding to 25 countries, thus enlarging what Bob Kagan has called the Kantian paradise in which the Europeans are supposed to live. Now, I've put in comparatively telegraphic form these basic changes, but they in turn carry with them a number of corollaries. But before getting to the corollaries, of course, it would be inaccurate to say that these changes exist purely in and of themselves. They are naturally influenced. They are naturally, they may well be, and they are indeed, aggravated by the play of personalities and ideologies. And in that respect, some of the corollaries of these changes are being made much starker, and the processes entailed by these corollaries are unfolding much more rapidly than would have been the case if we had had a different cast of actors in place, notably in the case of the United States of America. Now, what are the basic corollaries that I would draw? The first one is that the United States doesn't have a fundamental strategic reason to return to the multilateralist system in which it had invested itself with varying degrees of intensity in the period which extended from 1941, the year of the Atlantic Declaration, the year of Pearl Harbor, until 2001, the year of the election of the accession to power of George W. Bush, and of the attacks of September 11th. In particular, the permanent alliances of the Cold War have ceased to have the strategic raison d'être that they had in World War II and during the Cold War, and to quite a large extent during the Balkans Wars. In those decades, the coalition made the mission. The system which prevailed during that period is simply no longer an absolute strategic requirement. And Bob Kagan does have a point when he reminds his readers that America's embrace of multilateralism was often instrumental. Well, he tends to say essentially, and that I think is an exaggeration. But he is right in saying that there was that there has often been an instrumental element to it. These instrumental reasons have now disappeared. Furthermore, I would add that one of the things which makes the United, which characterizes a superpower, and the United States is the sole superpower, is the breadth of the spectrum of strategic alternatives which you have available to you. And in the case of the United States, the spectrum is actually quite large. And it would be a mistake in looking at the post-2001 world to simply say, oh, well, the alternative to Bush's unilateralism is simply going to be a return to some sort of multilateralism because the other potential choice, i.e. isolationism written in dark black letters, is simply impossible to contemplate. And I would agree with that. I mean, the type of isolationism which prevailed in the United States during the period from, let's say, 1931 to 1939, that sort of isolationism is probably not the sort of option which any sensible politician would care to embrace in the United States, and certainly would be at complete variance with the requirements, with the strategic requirements of America's security and defense. But if you look at pre-1941 America, and notably the America, the America which had already become one of the world's very great powers after the Civil War of 1861, 1865. If you look at the 80-year span between the Civil War and Pearl Harbor, you have practically every possible strategic stance available, from the brazen unilateralist imperialism of the War of 1898, to, of course, the ultra-isolationism, which I mentioned a few moments ago. But you also had episodes like the very active diplomacy of Theodore Roosevelt combined with highly selective military engagement. The strategic posture of the U.S. of the years 1901 to 1914. This was not a disengaged United States. It was not the United States who was living in purdah. It was the United States which was not involved in entangling alliances. That all of these postures have in common, no entangling alliances. But it's not sufficient to say that that the alternative to entangling alliances is pure and hard isolationism of the 1930s variety. There are plenty of other alternatives available, and the Europeans would do well to bear that in mind. Look at the choices facing the Americans. Let's project ourselves forward 1 year. Let us assume for a moment, and I would add that what I'm going to say has, to my view, a probability which is still rather less than 50%, but probably rather more than 10%. That is, in a year's time, the Iraq adventure is really seen as having been a debacle. The transfer of power to a sovereign Iraqi government degenerates into a civil war, Lebanization of Iraq, and a disgraceful withdrawal of the United States, and or, because the two things are unfortunately not incompatible, as we saw in Vietnam, a period of escalation and suffering for a very large number of people before withdrawal actually happens. What will then be the calculus in Washington once that has occurred, and beyond Washington, in the American body politic? Well, the conclusion could very well be that the costs of forward defense, which were perfectly acceptable between 1941 and 2001, have simply become too great in comparison to the alternative of investing in homeland defense, plus a Jeffersonian or Theodore Roosevelt type of diplomacy with America's partners, not excluding, of course, partnerships in the fight against terrorism with a global reach. First corollary. The second corollary involves the future of NATO. NATO is dead as a permanent defense alliance, but that does not mean that it has ceased to play other important roles. But in examining the prospects for the future of the US-European strategic partnership, it is important to be clear as to what NATO has ceased to be, and what NATO is or can be, and what NATO cannot be. So, first of all, what it no longer is. NATO is no longer a war machine. The Kosovo air campaign created not simply some fairly strong reactions in the US against war by committee. Those problems have been exaggerated, and the reactions have also been exaggerated. But what the war displayed very clearly is that that it was not sensible from a US standpoint to run a war with two competing chains of military command, each one of which was headed by an American general officer, each one of which was entitled to consider the other as his subordinate or auxiliary. SACUR, General Wesley Clark, was supposed to be the head of the operation as the chief military chief of NATO. And he was entitled to consider the Joint Chiefs of Staff in Washington as providers of military resources. And on the other side of the water, General Shelton, the Chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, considered that he had a subordinate called the Commander-in-Chief of the European Command, the theater commander, called General Wesley Clark. Well, in any large organization, and in particular in times of war and military organizations, this is a recipe for great tension, if not outright disaster. Disaster did not occur, could not occur given the discrepancy in the balance of forces, but we did have some very interesting moments between the leaders of the two chains of command. And this, of course, is a direct consequence of the end of the Cold War. 92% of the US force structure is not earmarked for assignment to NATO. So when you have a clash between the Chief of Joint Chiefs of Staff, who has to worry about the 92% and not simply about the 8%, and SACUR, who worries about the 8% but not about the 92%, you can imagine who is going to win out. And this is quite reasonable, quite normal. There's no critique involved here. This is in the nature of things. Secondly, what NATO still is. NATO is still a great lever for facilitating the transition to security sector reform and more broadly to democratic reform in the post-communist countries aspiring to membership. This is also a wasting asset. I mean, with the Big Bang enlargement in 2004, this leverage will continue to exist in some of the Balkans countries, Croatia, Albania, Macedonia, possibly in Ukraine, as I say, the cast of countries available in which to make this effect play is diminishing, and this, of course, is a consequence of the success of NATO. Secondly, and more importantly, NATO remains an absolutely essential provider of interoperability, standardization, and operating procedures between the armed forces of its members, or at least those elements of the armed forces of its members which have been earmarked for assignment to NATO, which means in practice the European members of NATO and the European command of the United States armed forces. Which is another way of saying that this is a function which is obviously important from an American perspective, but not vital. The Pacific Command or the Central Command or the Southern Command or the Northern Command of the United States Armed Forces barely know what NATO is. It may be the 10th planet of the solar system beyond Pluto. But EUCOM is still an important element, if only geographically, for the United States of America, since it embraces most of Africa and all of Europe and the Central Asian and Russian part of the Eurasian landmass. Important for the Americans, but vital for the Europeans. And there is no ready substitute for the Europeans to this function filled today by NATO. It's an instrumental role, it's a service provider role, but it's absolutely crucial. And here, as an analyst, I consider that the creation of the NATO response force and of the the Allied command transformation in Norfolk, these are positive steps in the field of enhancing the ability to generate interoperability, provided, of course, that these initiatives are not politically mismanaged. What NATO also still does is to serve, of course, as a focus for European North American security dialogue and cooperation. And what NATO has begun to do from the mid-90s onwards is to do what the United Nations used to do, that is, peace support operations with ISAF in Kabul, with S4 and K4 in the Balkans, being a latter-day equivalent of the successful operations of the United Nations in Cambodia, in Namibia, in Mozambique, etc. Very good stuff, but this does not in itself make NATO a defense alliance. However, once I've enumerated the things which NATO does, well, one sees that these tasks correspond to only a fraction of the overall transatlantic relationship and not necessarily to the strategically most important part of it. Real world security challenges, such as the Iraq crisis, or maybe beyond the horizon, the Iran crisis, are not dealt with primarily in NATO councils or consultations. Strategic relations with key players such as China or Russia are not handled in a transatlantic mode by either the US or the EU and its members. The non-military dimension of the fight against terrorism is not a NATO role, and even the military dimension is not primarily a NATO role. Strategically important issues such as the peace process, such as it is in the Middle East, or the security challenges in Africa are not dealt in NATO councils, or hardly so. Yet all of these issues have a potentially or actually strong transatlantic dimension, and they certainly have very substantial consequences. And naturally, I've left aside, as is natural from this enumeration, other key transatlantic issues, such as the future of free trade, the role of the World Trade Organization or the financial system, and so on. In other words, NATO does not have the breadth and the depth to be the fulcrum of the US, of the future of the US-European strategic relationship, even if, as I hope, it may continue to be an important part thereof. And now I move from the analysis concerning the alliance to the possibilities of generating a new partnership. In strategic terms, in my view, there will be no or little satisfaction gained in simply attempting to revert to the 1941-2001 multilateral model in the strategic arena. There are people in my own country, and maybe over here as well, who do tend to say, ce n'est qu'un mauvais moment à passer. Let's wait for the successors to these awful neocons, Bushies, etc. Whatever will follow will necessarily be a return to reality and therefore to the good old days of the multilateralist US-European template. I suspect that this is not going to happen, at least not in that way. What we should aim at is neither a return to the status quo ante, nor should we try to overburden NATO with tasks of the sort which I enumerated a few minutes ago, tasks for which it is incapable of handling politically or bureaucratically or in terms of its culture. The objective should be the establishment of something simultaneously more broadly based and less constraining. Less constraining because the mission determines the coalition. And this is where the partnership comes in. The European motivation would be to maintain civilized, friendly relations with the United States, agreeing to disagree on occasion, but not making life deliberately difficult for the American partners. And the American motivation into entering into such an association would be to facilitate European support of, and as the case may be, participation in US-led global policies, and generally to increase the possibility that such support may be forthcoming. But to achieve a working partnership, a number of limits need to be recognized and several conditions have to be met. First, in the short run, a calming down, a cooling down period needs to occur. And I hate to say this in the present tense. I would have hoped that by this time this would have happened. Although it is true that the Americans no longer talk openly about punishing the French, although the more asinine sorts of insults which were traded across the Atlantic at a certain stage in the Iraq crisis are no longer being used, be it in official discourse or more frequently in non-official discourse, the fact is that the wounds inflicted during the Iraq crisis remain open and raw. I am appalled to see that in the relationship between the Pentagon, for example, and its French partners, there has not been much positive evolution from the American side over the last 3 or 4 months. It is actually, in a sense, rather bizarre, because the fight against terrorism with a global reach is a shared and common interest and would normally lead sensible people to work together, at least in areas of such obvious joint concern. Secondly, it's not going to be very helpful, assuming that the cooling down period has happened, it's not going to be terribly helpful if proposals are put forward which simply assume that America and Europe share values and interests, and to repeat that 20 times in the same document. Now, this is what was done in the otherwise very well-meaning and helpful document produced by the CSIS, the so-called Joint Declaration, which was produced in early July, if my memory is correct, where very senior American former states people explained how important it was to maintain the transatlantic link, and obviously it's better to hear that than to fall ill. But the assumption always was we share values and interests. And ditto in the European responses thereto. There were a couple of responses of a similar make with Felipe González and Jacques Delors and many other former statesmen. But here again, it appeared to be sufficient to repeat the mantra for everything to go back to normal. Well, no, it's not true. Either there is a crisis and you have to explain why, or you're assuming that there is no crisis and you have to prove that. If there is a crisis, it surely does mean that it is no longer quite as self-evident that the values are identical or sufficiently identical to provide the same sort of glue as they did in the past, and that the interests are sufficiently solid to provide the basis for a permanent alliance. That needs to be proven. Thirdly, and more importantly, a partnership is not going to work if either side considers the other one as being part of the problem more than being part of the solution. For example, if from an American perspective, calls, whether they come from Moscow or Paris, for a multipolar world are probably not going to be considered as being compatible with a long-running partnership. A multipolar world means something which is directed in counterpoise to the United States of America. Seen from Washington, this is obviously not a perspective which leads naturally to partnership. I hasten to add that the French have been sensible enough to drop that sort of language since August. Initially, maybe with a tactical mindset, doing the same thing but no longer mentioning it, but also subsequently some substantive changes, and we can talk about that maybe in the discussion, linked in part to what happened in Cancun. What happened in Cancun was that we saw quite clearly that a multipolar vision and a multilateral vision were A, not exactly the same thing, and B, could actually be contradictory. And indeed, the US should have no cause to consider multilateralism, a multilateral vision, as something which should be fought. The Europeans cannot accept that the United States actively try to undermine the setting up of rules and regulations between consenting partners, even if the United States, it's perfectly understandable for the US not to be a partner in such rules and regulations. It's not helpful, but it's their sovereign right. But it's still something else to be seen as working actively against such rules and regulations between others. And the International Criminal Court is a good example of that. So as long as we remain on those sorts of trajectories, it's not going to be obvious to build a new partnership. Fourth, and I'll speak at some greater length on this before concluding, in the post-alliance world, a partnership cannot be sustained if the Europeans do not display a substantially greater amount of strategic seriousness. The US may be a weak superpower, we are not a superpower, and we are much weaker. Now, what do I mean by strategic seriousness? Essentially, three things. First, and I'll begin with soft power, maybe atypically, because the Europeans, and notably those who look towards the European Union, tend to pride themselves on their investment in terms of foreign policy, their investment into the non-military aspects of foreign policy. I'm using soft power as a proxy for the non-military aspects of foreign policy. I know Joe Nye would object to that use, and I beg his forgiveness because I'm hijacking his concept. Yes, it's true. The Europeans collectively spend a fair amount of money on official development assistance. Yes, it is true that we tend to be more keen than the Americans, at least the Americans of this administration, to seek for diplomatic solutions before unslinging our six-shooter. Let's look a little bit into the detail. The Europeans say we spend three times as much ODA, official development assistance, as the Americans do. Well, technically speaking, that's true, but not everything which is technically true is relevant. If you add on to the American expenditure, the monies which are given by non-official philanthropic foundations and institutions, well, the discrepancy is more like 1.5 to 1 rather than 3 to 1. So yes, the Europeans do spend more than the Americans on development assistance of all sorts and varieties, but we don't spend tremendously more. So we should already be slightly less mutually back-scratching on that one. Secondly, the Americans attempt, with varying degrees of success and in ways which can often be criticized, but they do try to establish some sort of link between security and development. It is, I think, generally true that security is unlikely to prevail in the absence of development in the long run, and also that in the absence of security, sustainable development is not going to occur. So the notion that you try to link your development assistance, your economic assistance, to the security dimension, is not one which strikes me as being absurd. The fact that the Americans have spent $8 billion over the last 10 years on the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program to deal with the venomous legacy of the former Soviet Union's weapons of mass destruction has been an extraordinary act of investment of soft power. And what would have happened if the Americans had not done this? because it is not the comparatively paltry 700 or 800 million dollars which the Europeans spent in the same time frame on the same issues which would have made the same sort of difference. Ukraine could well be a fully fledged nuclear power, so would Kazakhstan. Many of the sites where the tactical nuclear weapons were regrouped in Russia after the collapse of the former Soviet Union would not be quite as secure as they are today, and so on and so forth. Camp David. Some people may argue that the Americans shouldn't be spending quite so much money for a country as developed as Israel, but the fact is that the Americans, by giving money to Israel, Egypt, and Jordan, have helped sustain peace in those parts of the Israeli-Arab problem where peace does exist. Now, the Europeans pride themselves on spending about €1 billion a year on the Palestinian Near East account, if I can put it that way. But the Americans spend, setting aside the purely military aid, they spend about three times as much on that account, on the Near East account. Take Plan Colombia, which I would criticize for many reasons, but is it absolutely absurd for the Americans to try to gear assistance to a number of countries to attempting, at least, to bring back a modicum of security as a condition for development? The Europeans should do an audit of the security dimension and implications of their development assistance. Soft power, strategy. I'll come to the tools of hard power last. Strategy, the Europeans have, until very recently, tended to be essentially reactive to American proposals when it comes to the use of force. Tony Blair may have wanted to participate in the war against Iraq, but if the Americans hadn't wanted to go to war, we can be quite certain that Tony Blair would not have gone off on his own. So I think it's a beginning of wisdom. If the Americans had not been ready to go in the Kosovo air war, I doubt whether we would have summoned up the gumption to do something like the air campaign of 1999 in Kosovo. We have tended to be reactive. We have tended to act as consumers of security, which we indeed were during the Cold War. We, of course, also provided some security, but we were a minority provider in the broader framework with the Americans as the pace setter. That may have begun to change both at the national and at the EU level in the wake of the Iraq crisis. And here I will venture two propositions. One is the Solana document, which some people have called the strategic concept for the European Union. It's not quite that. The document which was submitted to and generally accepted by the European Council, which asked them to produce a more detailed document by the beginning of December. That's in a few days' time. That document, for the first time in an EU document, actually talks about bringing together the tools of soft power and hard power and about needing to prevent threats as well as needing to prevent conflicts. That is not simply doing the soft, cuddly stuff, you know, trying to defuse conflicts upstream, but actually timidly opening the window to the notion that there may be situations in which it may be necessary to act in a preventive manner. Now, some people, notably in my country, consider this as some of this as being a sop to the Americans in the making up process post Iraq war. The fact remains that the document was accepted by the 15, and indeed by the 25. Second proposition, changes in the UK and France. The French discovered in the Iraq crisis that although they were capable of securing very impressive diplomatic results. I mean, after all, we did manage to stop the second resolution in the Security Council. Against all odds. I mean, I couldn't meet a single British or American official in February who believed that we had any chance whatsoever at securing this result. Well, we secured. But at what cost? The collateral damage was phenomenal for our relations with the US, for our relations with half of our European partners, etc., etc. This is to diplomatic success what the success of our parachutists in Suez in 1956 was to military success. Perfectly successful. But where do you go from there? Where do you go from there? And ditto for the British. You went along with the Americans. You gave an enormous amount of quid. We ain't seen the quo yet. And it doesn't look like you're going to get it. Guantanamo, Iran, nothing much. It does look as if the operating systems which each of our countries put in place precisely after the Suez debacle in 56, that you stick to Washington, whatever, and we avoid any form of dependency which we possibly can on Washington, French, whatever, that operating system has begun, these operating systems have begun to break down. And that opens rather new prospects. Now, the tools of hard power, and I'll go very quickly before concluding. The European Union, as we all know, the Americans repeat it often enough, spends less than 40% of what the US spends on defense. I would add, that doesn't worry me terribly much. Anyway, we are not ensuring, providing security guarantees to South Korea, to Japan, to Taiwan, to the most militarized part of a theater of conflict that is East and South Asia. What does worry me terribly much is two things. The first is that the EU-15, and not to mention the EU-25, it gets much worse when you get to 25, we have more soldiers than the Americans, 1.6 versus 1.4. We have more battle tanks than the Americans, 9,250 versus 8,020. We have more artillery pieces than the Americans, actually 5,000 more than the Americans. We have not quite as many combat aircraft, but about 60% of the US number, and nearly as many combat helicopters. Now, an optimist would say, well, this proves that the Europeans are so much more efficient that they're defense spending than the Americans. Well, no, obviously that's not the case. It simply means that most of this stuff is undeployable, unusable, and George Robertson has unfortunately got it entirely right when he makes the critique of the lack of usability of our assets. We continue to be burdened, and when I say we, I mean the EU on as a whole. Some countries stand out, like Britain, my own just behind. You are the benchmark. The French come just behind. And a couple of others, like the Netherlands or Sweden, have been doing some very interesting things also in terms of military transformation. But overall, the manner in which we spend the money is absolutely pathetic. When we compare European and American defense spending, we see that the Americans spend about 15% of their defense spending on the preparation of the future. That's research and development. The number for the EU-15 is 7%. 10 billion euro in Europe, 50 billion US dollars in the United States, and I'm not saying that we should move from 10 to 50, that would obviously make no sense, but the ratio, and by the way, the ratio of 15% is about the same in the UK, and the French not very far behind. If the Europeans want to be competent in 10 years' time in the field of hard power, they simply have to double the share of their defense spending, their current defense spending, on that part which is devoted to research and development, moving from 10 billion euro to 20 billion euro a year, grosso modo. And furthermore, spending some of this on EU-wide ventures. I would add that the European Commission is actually working very hard to try to see how in the next budget compromise, instead of spending all of that money on the common agricultural policy, it wouldn't somehow be possible to use, let's say, somewhere between 1 and 2 billion euro a year on upstream R&D of the sort which is being put, for example, in a program of which Britain is a full partner, which is the Galileo Global Positioning Satellite program, which is 50% funded by the states of the European Space Agency and 50% from the community budget of the European Commission. And why do I insist on this aspect? Well, simply because there is an ultimate paradox to what I've been saying. That is, the ultimate paradox is that a US-European partnership will not thrive, and I'm not the first one to have said this, but it happens to be true, will not thrive if the Europeans continue to act as if the United States were in charge of the security of our Kantian paradise. A weak Europe is a recipe for non-partnership with the United States. Now, in conclusion, a word on institutions. And I have strenuously avoided focusing on institutions because I'm a great believer in doctrine and capabilities. But we still do need institutions. And if NATO can only bear a limited portion of the transatlantic, of the traffic of transatlantic relations, and if the current format of US-EU summits provides little continuity and also does not reflect the broad spectrum of the transatlantic relationship, well, we have to do something, we have to change something. And my own suggestion would be that as a consequence of the new constitution, hopefully coming up for ratification next year, that we should provide the US-European Union summits with a form of permanence and continuity. This could either be in the form of the foreign minister of the European Union, which is part of the current constitutional draft, or on an ad hoc basis under the European Council, but that the US-EU summits be entrusted with the substantive preparations of the US-EU meetings, along with the monitoring of the implementation of the decisions taken there, and precisely because we would be talking here about security and foreign policy, that the scope of the work of the summits firmly embrace the issues which I have mentioned until now. That has also begun to happen, by the way. We saw that at the last summit at the end of June, when the joint communique between the EU and the United States picked up the language from the Solana document, and notably the stuff about prevention. This, to me, is one possible way, one possible institutional approach to building up this partnership. But such steps may be necessary, but they are not in themselves sufficient. We need to do the more substantive things of the sort which I mentioned earlier on. More seriousness in hard power, more seriousness in soft power, more seriousness in strategic doctrine. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, Francois. We have some time for questions. Can you wait to be recognized? And when I've recognized you, can you wait for the microphone? And then can you please say who you are before you ask your question or make your comment?
Thank you. I am Rafael Papadopoulos. I am a retired university teacher. I came to this country as a political refugee in 1967. I would like to ask you a question. You said that the success of the French to prevent the second resolution over Iraq had a very great cost. Now, could I ask you to consider the cost of the alternative? That is, the cost of the failure in that effort, namely of the international community or the United Nations asking the Iraqis to disarm themselves or going to war because the Iraqis refused to disarm themselves from weapons which did not have. That means that we would have a United Nations sponsored war on false pretenses. And secondly, what would have been left of the authority and credibility of the world body so soon after NATO, at the behest of the Americans, bombed Yugoslavia outside the United Nations framework? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Do you want me to take a few?
Yes,
or?
No, I think.
Okay, I'll react immediately to that very important question. I'll answer in two parts. First, from the standpoint of pure French national interest, as I see it, and the second, indeed, from the standpoint of the future of the UN system. From the strict French national interest, it could well be argued that by taking a Putin-type stance, we would have suffered less. The second resolution would have passed, but we and the Russians and the Chinese would not have participated in the war. And we would have been free once it became apparent that the war had taken place on pretenses which were not exactly those which had been put to the Security Council by Mr. Colin Powell. We would have then been free to criticize. That would have reduced the collateral damage that we suffered, and it is not impossible to imagine that had we taken such a stance, that we would have found a broader degree of support within the membership of the European Union than we did. In the 10 days which separated the affirmation of the new French position on the war around January 20th and the publication of the letters of the 8 and of the 10, we had a radical hardening of positions, first from the French and the Germans, then from the others. If that hardening had not taken place in the way it did, the degree of disaffection which did occur between current and future members of the European Union would probably have been rather less. Now, the consequence for the international system, it's a very interesting counterfactual, that one. What would have happened if the Americans had said, in reaction to Jack Straw's benchmarks, you know, around March 12th or 13th. Jack Straw came up with these benchmarks. Don Rumsfeld immediately said, you remember, that if the if the British are not ready to go to war with us, we'll go without them. And President Chirac said, we'll never accept a compromise of any sort. Let's assume for a moment Don Rumsfeld kept his mouth shut, and Jacques Chirac also. And the Americans accepted to delay the war by 6 weeks or 2 months. Well, we know it didn't happen. And in that sense, it's impossible to answer the question. But the war would have happened. Saddam would have been overthrown. Hopefully, because Blix and Unmovic would have been considered as part of the operation rather than as something to be discarded, as the Americans did. Hopefully, we would have been able to lay our hands on some of the Iraqi archives and maybe at least find out what had happened between 1998 and 2003. Because one of the most extraordinary things in this war is that we still don't have a clue as to what happened to the assets which Iraq had before 1998 and those and the current situation. The Iraq Survey Group's report is paltry in terms of its findings, and that is in itself quite extraordinary. But what happened? Because the failure of intelligence, which is widely talked about in Britain and in the US, it's not pure, it's not only American and British. I mean, the Russian and the French intelligence agencies were not coming up with radically different assessments. They tended to be on the lower side of the spectrum of British and American assessments. But you know, when the French were coming up with estimates of a handful of Scuds, and the CIA was coming up with a handful of a figure of 45 Scuds, well, the figure for the moment is zero. And the difference between zero and a handful is much bigger than the difference between a handful and 45, because it's a difference between something and nothing. And for the moment, it's nothing. I think we would have had a crisis of our intelligence agencies rather than a crisis of the UN than of the UN as such. Because after all, doing something for reasons which were believed to be solid and good, it's not an excuse, but it's not a reason to shoot the UN either. Yeah, let me react to that. Three scores. First of all, this is rather a bit of a paradox. The European Union and the Americans essentially, the United States, not Canada, essentially found themselves in the same boat in Cancun. We were both protecting our agricultural markets against the Third World. One wonders whether it wouldn't have been better if we had been fighting about this topic rather than essentially agreeing about it. Extending the benefits of globalization to those areas in which the African countries in particular have a comparative advantage is something I think the Europeans should be accepting rather than working alongside the Americans in protecting the common agricultural policy on the one hand and the farm bill on the other. That's just a remark. Secondly, there is a threat. There is a set of threats, proliferation and terrorism with a global reach and the convergence of the two. Now, this is not a specifically transatlantic threat, but it doesn't hurt to have a transatlantic partnership in working against that threat alongside the Australians and the Japanese and the Chinese and the Russians. So there is some strategic glue, but it does not put NATO at the center. It does not put NATO at the pivot. And indeed, one of the more clever initiatives by the Bush administration it's rather easier to find less intelligent ones. The Proliferation Security Initiative, purely ad hoc coalition of like-minded countries with the willingness and the ability to do a number of things together to fight proliferation. The Spanish, the Italians, the French, the British, the Australians, the Japanese, the Americans. I'm leaving two or three out, I'm sorry. But that's a new age coalition. Very interesting. Democracy in the Middle East. This is one area in which my own difference with the Americans is much more on the means than on the end. The one area in which I have some intellectual respect for some of the neocons, not all of them, is on the issue of the future or the political evolution of the Middle East. The Europeans are always worrying about instability in the Middle East. Well, we are wrong to worry about instability in the Middle East because the Middle East, in strategic terms and political terms, is incredibly stable. Look at these regimes. You look at the Ba'athist regime in Syria. You look at the Wahhabis in Saudi. You look at Gaddafi. What is it? 34 years in power. Absolutely amazing. It's very difficult to find states in which you have such great lengths of regime continuity. Instability is not the issue. The issue is what is good for us in terms of the future evolution of the Middle East. And arguably, 9/11 should have driven home the point that we had reached that the balance between what we were getting out of the Middle East positively was being outweighed what we're getting from the Middle East negatively. 9/11 was a heavy, and the threat of terrorism of mass destruction is a very heavy price indeed to pay for oil. And I certainly agree with those who consider that maintaining the status quo in the Middle East, which is what American and European policy was essentially about until 9/11. Our governments dare to talk about human rights with the Chinese. China is not an inconsequential country. Even the EU has a human rights debate with China. There is a commission set up to talk about human rights. We force the Chinese to talk about human rights. They hate it, obviously, but we force them to do that because this was the price for getting into the WTO, etc. We considered that we could do this with China. We did not consider that we could do this with Saudi or Tunisia or Morocco or Syria. And I'm taking a ragtag. A lot of countries, because some of them are not major oil producers. Why we did that, I won't get into that because it's a long. It's a very interesting topic, which would take us quite some time. But the fact is that between Tangiers and the Indus, human rights and elections and freedom of assembly and NGO representation. We're not the sorts of topics which our prime ministers or our presidents forced the local leaderships to talk about. And here the neocons were right to say this is not possible, this cannot continue. That being said, Bonapartisme, is something which the French know a few things about, Bonapartisme is not the best way to export values. If you are successful in exporting your values, they actually tend to rebound, to boomerang against you. We spread nationalism and republicanism in Europe between 1794 and 1815. I'm not sure it did us a tremendous amount of good. And were the Americans successful in the Middle East, I am not sure how a democratic Iraq or indeed a democratic Iran would position itself vis-à-vis, let's say, issues like nuclear weapons. In the case of Iran, public opinion is solidly behind the acquisition of nuclear weapons. And I'm not sure a democratic Iran would be less eager to acquire weapons of mass destruction, possibly more eager than some of the more realpolitik-oriented autocrats, religious autocrats in that country.
Hello.
It works, yeah.
You seem to imply that you can achieve some degree of European knowledge in
Okay. Just make sure I'm not missing any of these. Let me start with the easy one. That's research and development. When one talks about a doubling, it always sounds very impressive. When one looks at the actual monies, you're talking about moving from 10 billion euro a year to 20 billion euro a year out of a total expenditure on defense of 150 billion euro. This is not the sort of thing which lies entirely outside of the realm of the feasible. If I take my own country, we have increased our capital spending on defense between 2002 and 2004. It increased from 11.9 to 14.9 billion euro. That's 3 billion euro in France alone. And that's an increase of the overall defense budget. In most of the European countries, normally this sort of thing should happen as a result of defense reform. If Britain and France are virtuous in terms of the proportions they spend on capital defense spending, particularly on R&D, it's because they have moved from old-style Cold War armies to all professional post-Cold War force projection forces. Germany, Poland, Italy have yet to undergo that process. Now, as long as Germany has to spend 80% of its defense budget on barracks and food and pay for its soldiers, this is not a clever way to spend one's defense money. So this is really more about intra-budget reallocation. If somebody explains to me that we cannot do this kind of shift, then we can do nothing, literally nothing, and that's simply not true. We can, and I mentioned the Commission earlier on. And this is not my wishful thinking, although initially it was. When I started talking with the folks in the Commission about 6 months ago about the manner in which the Commission could get involved in a systematic way in security R&D, security being the politically correct word for defense, in the Commission, building on the Galileo example, and they asked me, what kind of money are you talking about? What's enough to make a difference? Well, the commission, whatever its faults, has one great virtue. It tends to think actually quite big. That is, if it does something, and this is the bureaucratic empire building is part of it. But we also know that bureaucratic empire building can be a force of progress. What is enough to make a difference? I'm quite sure that if I had said 200 million euro a year, I would have been laughed out. But I said 2 billion. And I didn't, I won't do it here, but I spelled out why 2 billion rather than 800 million or 4 billion. Now you actually have the two commissioners who are in charge of R&D and information technology who are working like beavers on this. I'm quite confident that we will get to that kind of result as part of the future budget compromise. Touch wood. Russia. It was Churchill who said, was it in October 1939, an enigma on the BBC, an enigma wrapped in a riddle, in a mystery, or was it the other way around? And I'm afraid I'm no better than the next person in trying to divine the future course of Russia. That's très gentil, but there are signs of total lack of understanding by many people in the government, not least by the president of Russia, that until you have firmly established property rights, it is unlikely that you're going to get a normally functioning economy and polity. And that is very worrying indeed. I mean, I have no particular reason to jump to the defense of the Berezovskis and the Gusinskis and the Khodorovskis of this world. But you know, either you have privatized, and therefore you respect a certain number of basic rules which come along with the territory, or you're simply playing pakazucha for the gallery. And whenever one of these millionaires does something wrong, you simply consider that the right of property doesn't exist. That is immensely worrying. And I have great sympathy for those in the Baltic states or in Poland who have not entirely written off Russia as a potential threat, not in a 5 or 10 year perspective, but you know, in a longer term perspective. It's and the notion of wanting to have strong and real security guarantees, first in NATO, and it's fully understandable that they started with NATO, but eventually also in the framework of the European Union. One of the reasons, and this leads me to the last point about the first question you raised. First of all, I may be overconfident on this score, but I suspect that the new members of the European Union will be quite quick meaning here maybe 4 or 5 years, to appropriate the European Union. That is, they will consider, they will talk about the European Union as us, and not about they. And that will be a fundamental change. Poland may not be terribly good at it now, but it may become much better a few years down the road. After all, Spain, Portugal, and with much greater difficulties, but eventually came round to it too, Greece, eventually did appropriate the European Union. Secondly, the new members are serious on defense. They know what it means. And if the European Union is serious on defense, they will be serious on the European Union dimension of defense. I do not take the line that these guys are going to be negative players on the SDP. They're going to be negative players vis-a-vis those who are seen as trying to force a systematic choice between NATO and the European Union. Which is one of the reasons I didn't mention it, but I mention it now. I'm not a fan of Tervuren. I don't think Tervuren deserves the heaps of denunciation which the American ambassador to NATO has used against it. But Tervuren, I don't find it to be terribly helpful. I do find it rather wiser to hardwire European command arrangements, planning arrangements within NATO, under Deputy Sakur. Because when push comes to shove, the description I gave of NATO, what is NATO? NATO is may well turn out to be a coopération renforcée of the European Union, of which the American European Command happens to be a member of. Now that's a caricature, and it's obviously never going to emerge exactly like that. But who are the prime users of interoperability of the procedures within NATO? It's the Europeans. Who knows how to do it? It's NATO. I rather liked the language which Tony Blair used this afternoon concerning NATO and the European Union. We have to, how do you say in English, les ruses de l'histoire, the ruses of history. Do you say that? You know, Karl Marx's formula. About history sometimes working out in ways which are not exactly those which one assumed it was going to take. I think it is much cleverer for the Europeans to invest in NATO, to actually continue to invest in NATO. This does not prevent us and should not prevent us from building up the parts of the SDP which are not in direct competition with NATO. Because after all, we are members of NATO, and we should appropriate to us as much as possible. And one of the problems of NATO is maybe precisely that the Americans are not nearly as much involved as they would sometimes have us believe. Look at the NATO response force. Look at the NATO response force. This is supposed to be a common force between NATO's members. First two donors, force contributors, Spain and France. Which is the smallest donor in terms of force It's a battle between Luxembourg and the United States of America.
Professor, I have questioners backing up, but I think I'm only going to take two more, and I'll take them together. So, yes.
Okay, thank you.
First here.
Okay. I was going to ask you about the European Common Defence Policy, if you thought that was is actually something that's possible in the near future. And if Europe would manage to form a common defense policy, if that would act as a counterbalance to the American, even though it's not quite as strong, would it still be able to counterbalance American foreign, American defense policy?
I'm not sure.
Okay, my last question will touch on the transatlantic relationship and multipolarity. Okay. My question will touch on the transatlantic relationship and multipolarity. Briefly speaking, the demise of the Soviet Union meant the end of the ideological divide, and now multipolarity means that big powers can enter into alliances more freely, and based on their interests. I come to the question, given recent developments, for example, between Europe and China on human rights or Galileo. I'm going to ask you a provocative question. Don't you think that a rethought transatlantic relationship in the future will first come through and a rethinking of relations with Beijing, Tokyo, or Moscow? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me... I'll start with the last question, which is a very, very interesting and important one. Not Moscow, not Tokyo, but Beijing, possibly. Let me explain that. China is in that part of the world, which, as I said earlier on, is the most heavily militarized part of the world. It is the one in which the risks of conventional and non-conventional and nuclear conflict are along with what exists in South Asia, the most important in the world. This is where the concentration of forces is the greatest. The United States has security guarantees, bilateral security guarantees, vis-a-vis Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan. Therefore, whatever Europe does or doesn't do with China has a bearing on American interests. Conversely, Europe, the European Union, does not have direct security interests in East Asia. It has indirect security interests. Of course, the peace and prosperity in Northeast Asia are essential for our own prosperity, but we are not guarantors in the area. Therefore, we have a much wider margin of appreciation than the US does in terms of our relations with China. If, for example, the French or the British decided to sell top-of-the-line weapon systems in large quantities to China in lieu of Russia doing it, we would tremendously upset the United States. We would tremendously upset the United States, not because we would be in competition with the United States, they're not selling arms to China, but because we would be upsetting, in the most direct sense of the word, the strategic balance in East Asia. Therefore, indeed, it is to a large extent, it may be China, Europe's China policy, which could have a substantial effect on the state of transatlantic relations. It's also one of the reasons why I said earlier on that if we're going to have a partnership, neither of the partners must see the other as being actively working against the other's interests. It is not working against the US interest to refuse to go to Iraq. That was a war of American choice. It was America which decided that this is something it wanted to do. But by the same token, there would be a direct challenge to America's interests if the Europeans decided to do with China things which would affect the balance of power in that part of the world. And I say this not in a theoretical manner, because there is growing pressure in some of the continental European countries, I'm not sure about Britain, but in some of the continental European countries, there's growing pressure to release, to remove some of the restrictions on the transfer of critical technologies and weaponry to China, which is why your question was indeed a very, very timely one. That does not mean you're going to have a multipolar world in the sense of having a stable pole-to-pole relationship. The most important bilateral relationship for China for a long time will continue to be its relationship with Washington. Whether it's good, whether that relationship is good or bad, it will be the determining relationship, not the one it has with Paris or with Berlin or even with Moscow. So in that sense, I don't believe in multipolarity in a prescriptive sense that you will have guessed, but I don't actually terribly believe in it in a descriptive sense either. What I do see quite easily is that we are in a world in which the spread of economic and political power and the realities of demographics are such that even the most powerful country in the world can only be a weak unipole. We may be in a unipolar world, but it is a quite weak unipole. The question on common defense policy. Counterbalance, counterpoise, contrepoids. If we decide to have a common foreign security and defense policy, it's presumably because we consider that there are a number of interests and values which the European Union countries share and which lead them to want to be able to pursue these values. We do it because of us. We don't do it because of the US. At least we shouldn't be doing it because of the out of a spirit of competition with the US. We may have different visions on how to handle, let's say, an issue like that of Iran. Yes, we have a different vision. The British, the French, and the German vision are not the vision of John Bolton. That's quite clear. He was in town a couple of weeks ago, and without revealing any secrets, it was abundantly clear that he did not really share in any shape, size, or form the motivations of the Europeans, the three big Europeans, in their policy towards Iran. Well, if we consider that in some cases we do have a different approach, well, we need the tools to back that up. We have to be seen as serious partners. But it's not out of a spirit of competition that we should be that we should be doing this. And this is where some of the traditional Gaullist language in France, I think, has not been helpful. I think Chancellor Kohl got it absolutely right 20 years ago when we began the French-German security and defense dialogue. That's when it began, 20 years ago. Individually, I'm very proud of having been a direct participant in that process. But Kohl laid down the markers which needed to be laid down at the beginning of the process so that there would be no malentendu. He said very clearly, for us, it's not Washington or Paris, it's Washington and Paris. And it's precisely because that was the understanding between Paris and Bonn at the time, and subsequently Berlin, that that relationship has actually thrived quite nicely. And of course, to the extent that Washington is less interested, for good reasons, as I mentioned earlier on, in European security, and is much less engaged in NATO, well, the role that the Europeans play is ipso facto relatively greater than it was before. And this is, once again, in the nature des choses, the nature of things. It is not or should not be the result of, somewhat childish attitude of, mine is bigger than yours. I mean, that's not the way to go about it. The way to go about it is in the spirit of Saint-Malo, of what France and Britain wrote 5 years ago. Not quite to the day, but we'll be celebrating that anniversary in a few days' time. And I'm glad that we're beginning to get back to the spirit of that.
Francis, François, thank you very much for a wonderful lecture and for a very generous way in which you responded to the questions.
Thank you.